Wednesday, January 27th.
Madam Speaker, Mr. Vice President, members of Congress.
Join us for the president's speech and after the speech for analysis with NPR reporters and editors. The president's State of the Union address, Wednesday from NPR News.
Beginning at 8 p.m.
It's 2:40. In sports, the Chicago Cubs will keep their spring training home in Arizona. Governor Jan Brewer, senior lawmakers and officials from the Phoenix suburb of Mesa announced the Cubs' decision today at a news conference at the state capitol. Andre Dawson says he'd prefer to go into baseball's Hall of Fame as a Chicago Cub, but will be inducted as a Montreal Expo. It's the Hall of Fame's decision to make. Dawson played 11 years with the Expos before spending six seasons with the Cubs, including his MVP season of 1987. Illinois tries for a season sweep of Penn State as the two teams hook up tonight. The Illini men edged the Nittany Lions 54-53 at Assembly Hall earlier this month. The Chicago Bulls have struggled for much of the NBA season, but they could reach the 500 mark with a victory tonight in Oklahoma City. The Bulls have won three straight on their current road trip. They've split a pair of games with the Thunder this season. The Indiana Pacers host the LA Lakers tonight. And the St. Louis Blues face one of the NHL's hottest teams tonight. The Vancouver Canucks have won five straight and are 12-2-2 over their last 16 games. The Blues have won two of the three meetings between the two teams this season. The game tonight is in Vancouver. That's sports.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Provena Medical Group, Risk Management Commodities, Lafayette, and Springfield Electric, Springfield. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
It's 2:42. There is fierce competition among Republicans and Democrats who want to be governor. With a state deficit estimated as high as $13 billion, it's a wonder anyone is interested in the job. Across the board, all candidates say the solution to Illinois' fiscal problems will involve making cuts to state government. But they vary on the need for a tax increase. In the first of a two-part series, Amanda Vinicky outlines the budget proposals of the Democratic candidates for governor. Both say Illinois needs a higher income tax, but they differ on the details.
Say what you will about Rod Blagojevich's character and trustworthiness, but as Illinois' last governor, he held true to his word on at least one subject: taxes. Blagojevich kept his campaign promise to never raise them. Granted, he wasn't one to pinch pennies. Critics say Blagojevich's habit of introducing new and expensive programs like health care for all Illinois children when the state didn't really have the money to pay for it helped bring Illinois' budget to the brink. About a year ago, when Blagojevich was removed from office, his replacement, Pat Quinn, announced he wanted to reverse course and raise taxes.
Sometimes when you have a situation like we do, where the economy has fallen flat at the national level and the state revenues are very flat, we have to ask for a revenue increase in order to pay for health care and education and public safety.
But Quinn was never able to get a tax hike through the General Assembly, raising some questions about his leadership. Now, Quinn is trying to win over voters and keep his job, and his campaign is clearly trying to ease voters' fears that he'll reach into their pocketbooks. The governor says he's made $2 billion in cuts to the state budget already, and despite social service agencies and schools' complaints that they can't handle further cuts, Quinn says more are forthcoming. Here he is during a recent State of the State speech.
Now, I do believe we need more revenue. I think after cutting all the costs, after using strategic borrowing, after getting as much money as we can get from the federal government, we're still short.
He may not be as blatant about it, but Quinn says Illinois still needs an income tax increase, so he'll try again to pass one. Quinn's method doubles the income tax rate, raising what individuals pay from 3% to 5%. Lower-income families would get a break through higher exemptions. The governor also wants to double the earned income tax credit and give up to $500 in property tax relief. His opponent, Comptroller Dan Hines, says Quinn's plan leaves the middle class to pick up much of the tab.
When the governor had a chance to put forward a tax proposal that was fair and progressive and that would spare the middle class, he chose instead to tax the middle class.
Hines says that's a deep contrast between his tax increase plan, where only those making $200,000 a year or more would pay more in taxes. you can figure out where you'd fall at the Heinz campaign website, where there's a tax calculator. The math generally comes up with families paying less under the Heinz approach. That's because the comptroller's proposal keeps the tax rate at 3% for most people, then ramps up at higher income levels. Only those whose income reaches $1 million a year pay the maximum 7.5%. There is a catch. The state constitution doesn't allow a progressive tax structure. Illinois must tax everyone at a flat rate. So Heinz would have to get legislators and voters to approve changing the constitution. Not only is that a difficult task with no guarantee the results would be in his favor, it would take years. And that means pushing a revenue resolution off further.
But fear of a challenge shouldn't drive our policy. That's what got us here in the first place. Here's the bottom line. Strive for what's right and let people decide.
Heinz says it's not a problem because of other steps he'll take in the meantime. He wants to cut some corporate tax breaks, raise the cigarette tax, and rid state ranks of top administrators hired by Blagojevich, who are still on the payroll. He also wants to add 3 new casinos, including one in Chicago. And he says he'll start charging sales tax on services like elective cosmetic surgery and car rentals. For all of those differences, Heinz draws between his plan and Quinn's. Jeff McLynch with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy says they actually have a lot in common. He says both approaches address Illinois' regressive tax system, which leaves the poorest Illinois residents, not the wealthiest, spending the largest proportion of their incomes on taxes.
Both candidates' plans would speak to that fundamental inequity and try to use a more progressive, more fair income tax plan to try to treat that problem.
McLynch, whose nonpartisan group assesses state tax policies nationwide, says whatever approach wins, he believes there's no way Illinois can get around a tax increase. I'm Amanda Vinicky.
Tomorrow, a look at how Republicans running for governor would deal with the state's budget. It's 2:47 Central Time, 29 degrees in Urbana. Governments of some of the world's most polluting countries are scheduled to announce next Monday how much they're willing to limit their emissions of gases linked to global warming. If they're serious about meeting their commitments, they will all have to give some serious thought to the coal they use. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
It used to be that coal was king in the U.S. It's still royalty. Half our electricity comes from it. But now coal is guo wang. That's king in Chinese.
Coal is 80% of all power generation in China, and the Chinese use of coal is really one of the largest drivers of global coal consumption and hence global emissions.
That's Richard Morse, an energy analyst at Stanford University. Coal is the biggest single source of greenhouse gases. China and India are now huge consumers of coal, and their appetite is growing.
As long as economic development is a priority, I think climate takes a back seat. And in that situation, coal is going to win every time.
That's the conventional wisdom. But the deal made in Copenhagen may change that. By Monday, as many as 24 countries will have listed their emissions targets. China and the U.S., the two biggest coal users, are leading the group. India, another big coal power, is expected to join them. So will South Africa, a major coal exporter. So it's governments whose economies depend on coal who are now driving climate diplomacy by saying, OK, we'll cut our greenhouse gas emissions. And that means these countries will have to wrestle with the coal conundrum. We can't live without it, but we can't live with it. One energy expert who's watched this unfold is Trevor Hauser with the research firm RHG in New York. Hauser advised the U.S. climate team in Copenhagen. He says China actually might like to get off the coal train.
The coal in China is mined primarily in the northwest of the country, but the demand for that coal is in the east. And getting that coal from the mine to the power plant on the coast is a challenging and expensive undertaking.
2 years ago, an epic snowstorm shut down that supply chain. Power went out for millions of Chinese. Even China's trains stood still, stranding tens of thousands of people and a lot of coal. Hauser says it's the lack of a reliable and cheap way to transport coal that is pushing China to look for alternative fuels.
I think China has a strong incentive to move away from coal. I think there's going to be technical and economic challenges in doing it. but there's certainly a policy push to go that direction.
As for that other big consumer of coal, the U.S., the Obama administration has pledged to encourage more green energy from things like wind and solar power and to subsidize more efficient use of energy. But as energy economist Henry Jacoby of MIT points out, displacing coal is politically risky.
There are something like 22 states in the United States that have some level of coal production. Of course, that's not all the states that really care about it, because there are a number of other states whose electric power systems are heavily dependent on coal.
Jacoby points out something that politicians are loath to admit. Switching away from coal, which is cheap, so long as its negative environmental effects are not counted, will cost some consumers more on their utility bills.
If we don't have enough understanding of the climate issue for people to say, well, it's going to cost me a little bit more, but I think it's important enough. If we can't get to that point in the Congress, then we're not going to deal with the climate issue. It's a depressing thought.
But the Obama administration thinks there is an answer. Clean coal. That means extracting hydrogen from coal and using that to make electricity without emitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. The Department of Energy is spending $404 million this fiscal year to figure out how to do that. The Chinese government is also investing in the technology. So if coal does remain a big part of the energy mix for a few decades more, it may be by virtue of a new, untested technology whose final cost can only be guessed at. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
And next, we're going to hear about that technology. Burning coal emits a lot of carbon dioxide, the greenhouse gas contributing to climate change. The coal-burning electric power industry is just now testing technology to capture CO2 and to permanently store it. The second round of tests is happening at American Electric Power's Mountaineer Power Plant in New Haven, West Virginia. Hank Courtright is monitoring those tests. He's with the not-for-profit Electric Power Research Institute. Lester Graham talked with him and asked how the tests are going.
We think it has great progress. It's really the second step of a multi-step process that we're doing. We had just concluded a project up in Wisconsin on a smaller scale, the same type of technology, and it was very successful. Captured about 90-plus percent of the CO2 that passed through it, and saw some great promises as far as reducing the cost of doing it. The idea here is now we're scaling it up 10 times larger at the Mountaineer plant, and so far the early results seem very good, and we'll continue to test that probably over a year plus to see how it does produce.
I understand it takes a lot more energy to run this extra CO2 capture equipment. As much as 30% more coal has to be burned to generate the same amount of electricity, what's being called a parasitic load. So what's that going to mean for our power bills?
Well, what we're trying to get down to, Lester, is that parasitic load gets down into the, let's say, about the 10 to 15% range. If you get to that level, it means that the cost of electricity out of a coal plant might be about 25% higher than it is. But right now, coal is basically the cheapest form of producing electricity. So it still ends up as being an economical option, even though you might be increasing the price of that coal plant by about 25%.
If they can accomplish that with this experiment, how long will it take to get this technology built into the bulk of coal-burning power plants?
Well, you're going to be working over this for several decades, really. If this plant at Mountaineer works well, our thinking is around 2020, you're going to be able to have most new coal power plants use the carbon capture and storage, and you might be able to retrofit about 20%, 25% of the existing plants in the United States with this type of technology.
If all of these methods fizzle, we can't capture carbon economically. Or, at the other end, we can't find a way to sequester this carbon underground or whatever method they might come up with. What's next?
Well, that causes some difficulties because right here in the United States, coal is used to produce about half our electricity. And if it doesn't work on coal, it's also the issue is it won't work on any other fossil fuels such as natural gas, which produces about 20% of our electricity. So you're into a difficult situation that if you wanted to significantly reduce the CO2 emissions to improve the climate change issue, then you have to be looking at a combination of probably nuclear power and a very large rollout of renewable energy. Both of those would have to take the lion's share of the electricity production. But our hope is that we can get this working, because it's not only here in the U.S. you need it on fossil fuels of coal and gas, but also in places like China, Russia, India, Australia, countries that have very large reserves of coal and hope to use those natural resources.
Hank Courtwright is with the not-for-profit Electric Power Research Institute. He spoke with the Environment Report's Lester Graham.
Earth and Sky.
Wednesday, January 27th, 2010. Today, the planet Mars comes closest to Earth for all of this year.
In fact, this planet is now shining at its brilliant best for several years to come. Tonight's close encounter between the Earth and Mars will be the closest until the year 2014.
It's happening because in another 2 days, our planet Earth will pass in between the Sun and Mars. Astronomers call this an opposition of Mars. Earth orbits closer to the Sun than Mars does, and we move in orbit more swiftly than Mars. Our world laps Mars once every 780 Earth days, about every 2 years. When it happens, Mars appears at its best in our sky.
Or almost its best. Although Mars is now brighter and closer than it's been for 2 years, and then it will be again until 2014, it's not as bright and close as it can sometimes be. That cycle, the cycle of Mars' very best appearances in our sky, lasts for 15 years. Mars will have one of those amazing years about 8 years from now.
Still, it's a grand time now to see the red planet. Mars is out all night long now. Look for Mars in the east at nightfall, high up around midnight, and in the west as morning dawn starts to light the sky.
By the way, the planet directly opposite Mars at nightfall is an even brighter planet, Jupiter. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It is part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
A winter storm watch has been issued for extreme southern Illinois for tomorrow evening through Friday afternoon. Mike Sola's forecast for Illinois and Indiana tonight. In northern and central Illinois, cloudy with snow showers and flurries early, then partial clearing. In northern, central, and southeastern Indiana, cloudy with scattered snow showers and flurries. In southern Illinois and southwestern Indiana, cloudy with rain showers changing to freezing drizzle. Lows ranging from 2 in far northwestern Illinois to 30 in the far south. Tomorrow in northern Indiana, cloudy with scattered snow showers. In east, central, and southeastern Indiana, cloudy with scattered snow showers and flurries early, then becoming mostly sunny. Elsewhere, partly to mostly sunny. Lows ranging from 10 in far northern Illinois to 34 in the far south. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, cloudy with some light snow showers and flurries during the evening hours, then becoming partly cloudy after midnight, the low 13. The wind shifting from southwesterly to northwesterly at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny and colder, the high 19. The wind from the northwest at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy, the low 8. Friday, partly sunny, the high